Hi, if you've just started listening, I'm Kitty Fisher and this is a free audio tour of Brighton. There are no ads, but I've included a link for donations at the end. This podcast gives you the stories behind unusual buildings, unsolved murders and iconic institutions loved by the locals. The novelist Keith Waterhouse once described Brighton as a town that always looks as though it's helping the police with their inquiries. Personally, I feel that a town that's perverting the course of justice would be a more apt description. Scandals and unsolved crimes seem to be lurking around every corner. So if this gives you some material for a best-selling novel, please remember to leave a donation at the end. I'm going to start the tour at the West Pier, but you can start at any of the points listed in the programme notes. The West Pier is now just a rusting skeleton of what remains of a Grade 1 listed Victorian pier. Designed by Eugenius Birch, it was originally a wooden platform that enabled visitors to promenade and enjoy the healthy sea air. By the Edwardian era, about the time of the Titanic disaster, the pier had a domed concert hall and covered pavilions. It remained open to the public until 1975 when it closed due to safety concerns. The pier stayed closed for the next 28 years, during which time campaigners raised money to reopen the pier and a number of plans for restoration fell through. Then, in March 2003, part of the pier was destroyed by an arson attack, and in May of the same year, another fire occurred. A letter to the Evening Argus claiming responsibility for the fire was mysteriously signed by Piers Burns, but the police were unable to trace its sender. Shortly before the second fire broke out, there were reports of a man climbing on the pier, but again, this man has never been found. Since the pier closed, it's taken on a new role as a rather glamorous backdrop for one of the most incredible natural spectacles, starling murmurations. In the autumn and winter months, huge clouds of the birds can be seen swarming close to the West Pier. Up to 40,000 birds swirl around, changing direction and forming increasingly larger groups. Because starlings are partial migrants, birds from colder climates will join British birds during the winter months. It is thought that murmurations are a survival mechanism that deter predators, making individual birds harder to attack. Continue walking in the direction of the Palace Pier, stopping just below the Grand Hotel. This is next to the red brick Metropole Hotel and just above the Pump Rooms Cafe, which is in an archway below the road. The Pump Rooms originally housed a pump that brought seawater to the luxury hotels along the seafront. In the 1800s, the Metropole Hotel had hot, cold and seawater taps in every room, while the Grand Hotel incorporated a seawater bathing pool to the left-hand side of the building. But the Grand Hotel is probably better known for the 1984 bombing by the IRA during the Conservative Party conference. The bombing of the Grand Hotel has been described as the most audacious attack on the British government since the gunpowder plot. On October the 12th, 1984, at 3 a.m, a bomb exploded in the hotel. The Prime Minister of the time, Margaret Thatcher, survived the attack, but 5 people were killed and a further 31 were injured. Although little remained of the area where the bomb had been planted, it was discovered that a long-delay time bomb had been the cause of the explosion. Using hotel guest records, suspicion eventually fell on a man by the name of Roy Walsh, who had stayed in room 629. The police were unable to find Mr. Walsh, who was in fact provisional IRA member Patrick McGee. When staff were questioned about Mr. McGee, they remembered that he wore a heavy coat despite it being one of the hottest days of the year, and the chambermaid noticed marks on the side of the bath suggesting that a panel had been removed to conceal the bomb. Patrick McGee was arrested in 1985 and sentenced to 35 years in prison. He was released as part of the Good Friday Agreement after serving 14 years of his sentence. Continue walking in the direction of the Palace Pier until you get to a modern building that looks like it has a Toblerone around the top. This is the Odeon Cinema at the bottom of West Street, the location of a bizarre poisoning. West Street is the western boundary of the old town of Brighton, which is now called the Lanes, and one of the haunts of the chocolate cream killer. In the 1870s, Christiana Edmonds moved to Brighton with her elderly mother. She fell in love with a neighbour, Dr. Charles Beard, and the two of them exchanged passionate letters and may have had an affair. Unfortunately for Christiana, Dr. Beard was married. Undeterred, Christiana visited Mrs. Beard with a gift of chocolates, but these were no ordinary chocolates. They were laced with strychnine. Mrs. Beard tasted the chocolates and became suspicious. She informed her husband, who forbid Christiana from visiting the house, but Christiana was determined to prove her innocence. She did this by framing the sweet shop owner. She bought more sweets from the shop, added poison, and exchanged them for others. The owner of the shop then sold the chocolates to other customers. She then asked local boys to buy chocolates for her and gifted them to wealthy residents. She even claimed that she herself had been a victim of the poisoner. The shop owner was questioned by the police and the stock was destroyed. But the poisonings continued. One victim, a 4-year-old boy, died as a result of eating the chocolates, and many others became ill. Eventually, a reward was offered for information leading to an arrest, and at this point, Dr. Beard came forward with his suspicions about Christiana. At her trial, Christiana faced the death penalty, but was sentenced to life in Broadmoor Secure Hospital for the criminally insane. Now we're going to continue walking in the direction of the Palace Pier until we get to the Fishing Museum. While we're walking, I'm going to talk about Brighton's development in the Regency period. Brighton would have been a small fishing community until the 1740s, when a Dr. Russell from Lewes published a dissertation on the benefits of bathing and even drinking seawater. By 1747, he had relocated to Brighton, where he had a house built on the seafront and treated his patients there. The popularity of the seawater cure brought wealthy visitors, and even after Russell's death, the heir to the throne, the Prince Regent, built his royal pavilion here, ensuring Brighton's popularity as a spa town. The trend for sea bathing created employment opportunities for local people, and a number of men and women were employed as bathers and dippers. Their job was to guide the horse-drawn bathing machines into the sea so that their clients could immerse themselves in the water. The bathing machines were heavy wooden sheds that allowed bathers to change their clothes and be carried into the sea without walking down the pebbly beach. Martha Gunn was the most well-known and popular of these dippers, and her career spanned over 60 years. Her house and her grave are a little further around on this tour. When you get to the Fishing Museum, walk up the slope and cross the road to the Old Ship Hotel. We're now standing in front of the Old Ship Hotel. This is the oldest hotel in Brighton and was built in 1559. In 1670, the hotel was bought by Nicholas Tattersall, who owned the ship that took Charles II to France to escape Cromwell's army. He had been told that he was taking two men to France to escape a duel, but recognised Charles immediately, as even without a long black wig, he was 6'4" and with an unusually dark complexion. When Charles returned from France and the monarchy was restored, Nicholas Tattersall rose to the position of High Constable of Brighton. But it seems he was an unpleasant character who spent much of his time persecuting Quakers and other nonconformists. Turn left in front of the Old Ship Hotel and walk up Ship Street. Ship Street developed at the start of the 17th century and was known as the Street of the Hempshires. At that time, hemp was an important crop for the navy and fishing industry because it was used to make rope and cork ships. Without it, there would have been no food, no defence from invaders, and no British Empire. Although hemp is also used to make cannabis, nobody in Brighton seems to have considered smoking it at that time. At the bottom of Ship Street, the Hotel Divan was once a wine merchant's and booking office for cross-channel journeys. The current building is more modern, but built in a mock Tudor and Gothic style. On the opposite side of the road to the Hotel Divan, number 69 is made from dark grey squares of napped flint. Flint is the stone that makes the pebbles on the beach. Many Regency houses in Brighton are fronted with whole pebbles that are painted black. Napped comes from the Old Norse word to hit or hammer. This means that the pebbles would have been broken to create a flat surface. A lot of the churches in Brighton are made from napped flint, but it is unusual to see squared flints that would have required a great deal of skill to break so perfectly. The work of napping was very dangerous. Without eye protection, you could easily damage your eyes. But the worst disease was napper's rot. This was silicosis, a lung disease caused by inhaling flint dust. It's described as the first industrial disease, and many nappers died before the age of 50. A little way down Ship Street, a narrow alleyway cuts across the road. The old word for these narrow lanes are twittens. To the right, Black Lion Lane is said to have been where Charles II was carried piggyback by a fisherman as he escaped Cromwell's army. In the 1800s, a rather overweight man by the name of Mr. Bullock challenged the younger fitter, Lord Barrymore, to a race on the grounds that he chose the location and was given a 10-yard start. It was agreed, and Mr. Bullock chose Black Lion Lane. Unable to pass him, Lord Barrymore lost the race, while Mr. Bullock simply strolled along to the finish line. Carry on walking up Ship Street and cross over Prince Albert Street. You're now standing outside the Friends Meeting House. This is owned by the Quakers, and if the gate is open, the garden has a sign welcoming visitors. The garden is also a burial ground. and 54 adults and 34 children are buried here in unmarked graves. Continue up Ship Street a little way until you're at the entrance of Union Street. Opposite is the Seven Stars pub. This is a late Victorian building in a very ornate Gothic style. Turn right down Union Street, where there are many well-preserved 18th and 19th century buildings. At the end of the road on the left is what was once a Presbyterian chapel. Erected in 1698, it was the first nonconformist chapel in Brighton. Although it was rebuilt and enlarged in 1825, the side of the building that faces Meeting House Lane is much earlier. Turn right at the T-junction at the end and follow the road round to the left and then turn right towards the sea. This is taking us around the back of the Quaker Meeting House. Look out for a bricked-up archway in the wall on the right. This is said to be the place where a ghost of a nun is seen. The apparition is dressed in grey and is thought to be a woman who had an affair with a soldier. It is said that she was bricked up here as a punishment. Now we're going to continue along the alley to the point where the road widens out and intersects Prince Albert Street, because there are two interesting pubs here. Just opposite, you can see the Cricketers and the Black Lion. The Cricketers is the oldest public house in continual use in the town. It dates from around 1545, and there is a room dedicated to Graham Greene, who wrote Brighton Rock. Next door to the Cricketers is the Black Lion. This was originally a brewery established by Derek Carver, a Flemish immigrant escaping religious persecution. The Black Lion comes from the Flemish coat of arms. In 1553, Mary Tudor, or Bloody Mary as she was known by her opponents, attempted to reverse the Protestant Reformation. As a Protestant, Carver was arrested in 1554, and after being imprisoned and interrogated in Newgate Prison, London, he was burned in a barrel in Lewes. During Mary's five-year reign, around 300 people were burned for their religious beliefs. Today, the town of Lewes still commemorates the Protestant martyrs by burning an effigy of the Pope on November the 5th each year. Turn left down Nile Street and left at the bottom of the road, where you will be in a triangular sloping area. At the top of the triangle is the pump house. Like the pump rooms on the seafront, this building pumped seawater to hostelries in the area. There's a stone fireplace in the bar, which has the initials of Miss Elliot, who bought the building in 1766. Near here, there was a public well in the area called the Nab. According to the old police cells website, on the 25th of May, 1794, the head of an unknown prostitute was found in the public well by workmen. It doesn't give any more information about the incident, but it's believed that the prostitute was known to the Prince Regent, whose pavilion was built in 1787. From the pump house, walk down the slope through the narrow alleyway to the side of the Sussex pub. The alleyway opens out into a square at the side of East Street. On the right-hand side of this square is English's Seafood Restaurant. The restaurant is one of the oldest and most well-known restaurants in the country. Owned by the Lee Jones family since 1945, guests have included Charlie Chaplin, Jeremy Irons, Joan Collins, Laurence Olivier and Tony Blair. Next to the Sussex pub in the northwest corner of the square is the house of Martha Gunn, the sea dipper. She had eight children and died in 1815. Her grave is in St Nicholas Churchyard, which we will visit near to the end of the walk. We're now in East Street. This marks the eastern boundary of the old town. Beyond East Street is the old Steen. Steen comes from the Old English stone, meaning stony place. A large number of Sarsen stones were once found in the area. Sarsen means Saracen in the Wiltshire dialect. It meant Muslim and denotes anything non-Christian or pagan. The Old Steen is the place where some of the first wealthy residents had houses built. Dr. Russell lived there, and Mrs. Fitzherbert, the Prince Regent's mistress, had a house in the Steen. From East Street, walk north towards the Indian Gate leading into the Pavilion Gardens. The Indian Gate was a gift from India to mark British hospitality to Indian soldiers during the First World War. During the war, the pavilion was used as a hospital for Indian servicemen. The blue plaque to the right of the Indian Gate commemorates Subedar Mir Dast, who was awarded the Victoria Cross for rescuing eight soldiers whilst under enemy fire. Go through the Indian Gate and follow the path around the gardens in the direction of the dome. During the Second World War, a Nazi propaganda broadcaster claimed that the pavilion would not be bombed, as Hitler planned to use it as his summer residence. Brighton Art Gallery and the Dome were originally the Prince Regent's riding stables, and he built an underground tunnel to take him to the stables without being seen by the public. The path comes out in New Road. The original road was relocated further east to this position, away from the Royal Palace. The Theatre Royal, which is just opposite the pavilion, in New Road, is one of the oldest and most distinguished theatres in the country. The Colonnade Bar, which is to the right of the theatre, was a place where actors, critics and theatre lovers often met. Laurence Olivier, Marlene Dietrich, Sir John Gielgud and Dame Judi Dench have all played at this theatre. If you're facing the theatre, turn right, heading north away from the direction of the sea. On your left, just before the end of the road, is the Unitarian Church. This was designed by Eamon Henry Wiles in Greek Revival style and modelled on the Temple of Theseus in Athens. At the end of the road, turn left into Church Street. The black pebble-fronted building on the left was originally opened as the Regent Hotel in the early 1800s. Next door is Dockrell's, established in 1915. It's still owned and run by the same family. Take the second turning to the right, which is Garden Street, in the heart of the North Lane area. This street was developed in the early 1820s. Between 1800 and 1840, Brighton's population grew from 7,000 to over 40,000. By the 1850s, there were up to 17 people living in some of these houses. There would have been no sewers, no running water, and no refrigeration. With butchers' shops, grocers, pubs, and other businesses spilling out onto the street, this would have been a very vibrant and smelly place to live. On the horizon, you can just see Theobald House, a 22-storey tower block built in 1967. This was the start of a slum clearance project that aimed to replace this area. Opposition to the demolition by planning officer Ken Fiennes and a number of other residents ensured that this area was preserved, and the name North Lane was adopted from traditional Sussex dialect, meaning an open tract of land, which marked out this area as one of several lanes around the old town. At the end of Gardiner Street on the right is Infinity Foods. This business started as a macrobiotic restaurant at Sussex University. As their popularity grew, they decided to open a whole food shop but lacked the funds. However, their luck changed when their washer-upper, Andy the Anarchist's aunt, died, leaving him all her money. As he didn't believe in owning property, he happily gave it to his friends to buy this shop. At the end of the road, cross at the crossing and walk along Kensington Gardens. In the middle of Kensington Gardens is Snooper's Paradise, two floors of vintage clothing, antiques, and second-hand records and books. At the end of the road is a chip shop. We're going to turn left here and then go up the road to Upper Gardiner Street, which is first on the left. Follow the road back in the direction that we came. The numbers on the floor indicate where stalls are set up for the Saturday market. This street has had a market since the 1890s and Victorian barrow boys would sell their wares here. Just a couple of streets up from here and a little nearer to the station is Kemp Street. This is the infamous location of one of Brighton's most well-known murders. In 1934, a local builder noticed a smell coming from a property in Kemp Street. When police investigated, they found the body of 41-year-old Violet Kay hidden in a trunk. At the trial of her boyfriend, Tony Mancini, who was described as a violent, unpredictable, petty criminal, it was discovered that he had taken the body with him from another residence and had placed the trunk at the end of the bed where he had used it as a coffee table. Despite complaints about the smell and body fluids oozing from the trunk, it remained in the room until it was discovered by the police. What added to the notoriety of the case is that Tony Mancini was not convicted of the murder. Violet Kay worked as a prostitute and was a drug addict. In court, her boyfriend claimed that he had found Violet Kay's dead body and hidden it. He hadn't gone to the police because he had a criminal record and would be assumed to be guilty. In 1976, just before his death, he confessed to the murder. At the end of Upper Gardiner Street, turn left and then right and go back along Gardiner Street. On top of the Commedia Theatre and cinema, you can see a pair of stripy legs on the canopy over the entrance. The legs were made by Jamie McCartney. Jamie is more famous for a work called The Great Wall of Vagina, created in 2008. It's a cast of 400 women's vaginas. In an interview, he stated that he was inspired to create this piece to counter body fascism and the rise of procedures dictating how women should look. Opposite the Commedia is Vegetarian Shoes. This building was originally a charity school for girls. In a school inspector's report, it stated that when the windows were open, the ears and eyes of the children and female visitors are constantly offended with evil language. At the end of the road, turn right and walk up the steep hill until you get to Queen's Road, which runs from Brighton Station down to the sea. This is a fairly unattractive street with a multi-storey car park and empty buildings. In the 1850s, a report by Dr. Kemble stated that in no other town in the kingdom do the extremes of cleanliness and squalor exist more than in Brighton. Between 1840 and 1850, outbreaks of whooping cough, scarlet fever, smallpox and consumption killed hundreds of people in the poorer areas of town. A review of the living conditions at the time revealed sewage seeping through the walls of the houses, cesspools unemptied for 5 or 6 years, and slaughterhouses discharging directly into the streets. When cholera broke out in 1848, the authorities refused to acknowledge it for fear of tarnishing the town's reputation. At Queen's Road, cross over and continue up the hill to St Nicholas Church. At the top of the road on the left-hand side is the Church of St Nicholas. Take the entrance just below the church into the graveyard. The Domesday Book records the presence of a church in Brighthelmston, the old name for the town. The current church is mid-14th century and is one of the oldest buildings in Brighton. It survived a raid by French pirates who burnt the medieval town in 1533. If you follow the path around the church, the first grave protected by iron railings is that of Martha Gunn, the Dipper, and her husband and 4 of her children. Further round and slightly further down the hill is another interesting monument that is protected by railings. This is the grave of Phoebe Hessel. Phoebe was born in London in 1713. At the age of 15, she disguised herself as a man and joined the army as a foot soldier and fought in Europe and the Caribbean. Whilst fighting in Belgium, she was wounded in the arm and discharged from the army. She went on to marry twice and have 9 children. In her later years, she sold gingerbread in the Steen Gardens and was invited to George IV's coronation at Westminster Abbey. She died age 108. Another notable grave is that of John Vyse. He was a surgical instrument maker and was so anxious about the possibility of being buried alive that he designed his own coffin. It had a spike that would penetrate through his heart when the lid was shut. Just down the hill from the church are the grey and white houses of Wickham Terrace. These houses were built around 1830 and are attributed to Eamon Henry Wildes. Their Gothic style is quite unusual for Brighton. In 1850, it's estimated that there were 325 prostitutes in Brighton. This included 25 children. Several of these houses were bought by Reverend Henry Wagner, who converted them to a home for former prostitutes. The women were offered healthcare, education and training and were supervised by nuns. They are now private residences once again, and a 3-bedroom house here currently sells for over £1 million. Follow the path around the church and continue up the hill to the gate that leads back into Church Street. The last grave on the left has an inscription to her sister from Tryphena Pendarves. The information about the sister is more detailed than that of Elizabeth, the woman the stone is commemorating. Tryphena Pendarves died at the age of 94 and is said to be buried in the Pendarve Mausoleum in Cornwall. However, local legend claims that her ghost wanders the estate because she was buried elsewhere due to certain unstated misdemeanours. When you leave the graveyard, cross Church Road and then cross the main road and walk up. Take the first turning left, which is Clifton Terrace. Clifton Terrace is one of the most exclusive residential areas in central Brighton. Built in 1846 by the owners of Baring Bank and the East India Company, the clean air west of the station and on higher ground away from the old fishing village made properties in this area more desirable. The houses here are now part of the Cliftonville Conservation Area. This means that residents are required to repaint their houses every 2 years, and the colours and types of paint are strictly regulated. The price of a 5-bedroom house in this road is currently around £1.5 million. Looking towards the sea from here, you can see the tower blocks of Sussex Heights. Sussex Heights is a 24-storey block of luxury apartments built between 1966 and 68. It consists of 115 flats with a large penthouse taking up the whole of the top floor. For several years, peregrine falcons have nested at the top of this building and residents have a webcam monitoring the nests. A 2-bedroom flat on the 20th floor was recently sold for around £500,000. At the end of the road, turn right into Powers Court and then immediately left and left again so that you are walking down Victoria Street. At the top of Victoria Street, on the opposite side of the road, is a plaque dedicated to Minnie Turner, suffragette. Minnie was brought up just down the hill in Preston Street where her family owned a shop. Whilst running Seaview Guesthouse, she became interested in politics, and her guesthouse became a haven for suffragettes and speakers campaigning for the rights of women. In 1906, the new Liberal government had promised women the vote, so women like Minnie campaigned tirelessly for the Liberal Party and felt let down when they broke their promise. In 1911, during a protest in London, she broke a window of the Home Office and was sentenced to 3 weeks in prison. Minnie's own windows were broken by rowdy youths, and Minnie and her fellow suffragettes put up a sign in the broken window declaring, "Masculine logic, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery." Turner was awarded the Hunger Strike Medal for valour. She died in 1948, aged 82. Out to sea, you can see the Rampion Wind Farm, which generates enough green energy to supply 350,000 homes. It's the first offshore wind farm on the south coast of England. When you reach the church at the bottom of the hill, turn right and then left down the side of Billy's Cafe. At the end of this road, near the bottom on the right, is the back entrance of Waitrose Car Park. These houses were originally owned by the Codrington family. Admiral Sir Edward Codrington was commemorated for his career in the Navy by a plaque in Weston Road. The plaque commemorates him as a hero of the Battle of Navarino, and was removed in 2020 as a result of the family's links to slavery. Codrington's status as a hero or villain is a controversial one. On the one hand, he's considered a hero in the Greek War of Independence, where he commanded a fleet that destroyed Ottoman invaders. Despite this, he inherited slave plantations in Barbados and received compensation for his loss of income from the Slave Compensation Act of 1837. Even by the standards of the day, the Codrington estate was described as exceptionally brutal. So the status of Edward Codrington is still a subject of debate. When you reach Weston Road, turn right, cross over and walk down Silwood Road. About halfway down the road at number 11 is another blue plaque marking the house where the artist John Constable stayed. In the 1820s, when Constable stayed here, this street was the western boundary of the town, and the area facing Constable's house would have been the garden of Mrs. Anne Sober. Mrs. Sober was the sister of the builder, Thomas Kemp, who built Kemptown, and she lived in a Gothic-style western lodge at the top of the hill, which is now number 96 Weston Road. Looking down Silwood Street towards the sea, you can see the 17-storey tower block that was built on the site of the old Bedford Hotel. It was one of the first luxury hotels built along the seafront and was visited by Charles Dickens. In the 1960s, the owners of the hotel were in dispute with conservationists about plans to demolish the hotel when a fire broke out, destroying the original building. Two people died in the fire, and although the cause was never discovered, some believe that it was started intentionally. Turn right at the bottom of the road and continue along to Oriental Place. At the top of Oriental Place is a private gateway into Silwood Mansions. This area was designed by Eamon Wiles, and until the 1960s there were Regency buildings on both sides. A steam-heated glass house that looked like a miniature version of the Royal Pavilion was originally planned on the site, but was never built. Now walk down Oriental Place towards the sea. This is the last part of the tour, and along this road, you can see that there are unusual ammonite fossil designs at the top of the columns. These are a motif adopted by the architect, Eamon Wiles, possibly as a pun on his name. At the end of the road, you will see the I-360 and the remains of the West Pier, which is the point where we started our tour, and where this walk ends. Thank you for listening.